The following is a class on the Srimad Bhagavatam, 12th canto, 3rd chapter, text number 32, by His Divine Grace, Sri Lotamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj Gurudev, given April 19, 1985, in Houston.
Yut Krishna Janapada, Veda Pashanda Dushitaha. Rajanyascha praja bhakshaha Shishnodara paradvijaha Dasyu utkrishna predominated by thieves. Janapada, the populated places. Vedaha, the Vedic scriptures. Pashanda, by atheists. Dushitaha, contaminated. Rajanya, the political leaders. Cha, and Prajabhakshaha, consuming the populace. Shishna udara, to the genitals and belly. Paraha, dedicated. Dvijaha, the Brahmins. Translation and purport by Srila Charidev. Cities will be dominated by thieves. The Vedas will be contaminated by speculative interpretation of atheists. Political leaders will virtually consume the citizens, and the so-called priests and intellectuals will be devotees of their bellies and genitals. This is the 32nd text, 3rd chapter of the 12th canto. The chapter entitled the Bhumi Gita, section entitled Further Symptoms of the Age of Kali. Purport. Many large cities are unsafe at night. For example, it is understood that no sane person will walk in New York's Central Park at night because he knows he will almost certainly be mugged. Apart from ordinary thieves who are bound in this age, large cities are filled with cutthroat businessmen who enthusiastically convince people to purchase and consume useless or even harmful products. It has been well documented that beef, tobacco, liquor, and many other modern products destroy one's physical health. What to speak of mental health? And yet modern capitalists do not hesitate to use every psychological trick in the book to convince people to consume these things. Modern cities are full of mental and atmospheric pollution, and even ordinary citizens are finding them unbearable. This verse also points out that the teachings of the Vedic scriptures will be distorted in this age. Great universities teach courses on Hinduism in which Indian religion, despite limitless evidence to the contrary, is described as polytheistic and leading to an impersonal salvation. In fact, all Vedic literature is a unified whole, as stated by Lord Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita, 15th chapter, 15th verse. Videscha sarvera hameva vedyaha. By all the Vedas, I, Krishna, am to be known. All Vedic literature is meant for enlightening us about the Supreme Personal, Absolute Truth, Vishnu or Krishna. Although known by many names and appearing in many forms, God is a single absolute entity, and He is a person. But this true Vedic understanding is hidden in the Kali Yuga. In this verse, Sukhdev Goswami astutely observes that, quotes, political leaders will virtually consume the citizens, and the so-called priests and intellectuals will be devotees of their bellies and genitals. How sadly true this statement is. And get it again. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasadaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesa Sundavani Paskata Deshatarine Anchakalpaturu Vaishja Kripa Shindu Bihi Pachapati Tanam Pavane Bio Vaishnave Bio Namo Namaha. So we have been lecturing successively on the various verses of the 12th canto, which describe this age that we're living in, known as Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. It is interesting because it especially contains many prophecies. And in the state of Texas, which is known as the buckle of the Bible Belt, people are very much attracted by prophecy, because this is one of the ways in which they have faith in their scripture, the Bible. Just like their worshipful guru, Lord Jesus, performed many miracles which made them have more faith in him. Similarly, when we see prophecy, persons who are not always so devoted become very much impressed. So we also have got our prophecy, this 12th canto, which describes 5,000 years ago what is taking place today and will gradually take place more and more. Therefore, this book is very important. It will become very important as it is distributed in terms of people's developing an appreciation for the vision of the Bhagavatam. Srila Vyasadeva, the compiler of the entire Vedas, is known as Trikalagya because he is able to see the past, the present, and the future. And in fact, anyone who is a follower of Srila Vyasadeva can also be blessed with such astute vision, because our vision is not based upon imperfect sense perception. It is based upon hearing. Hearing from genuine authorities. This is not a concocted method. Rather, it is a method of faithful repetition. We find nothing wrong with repetition, providing that we are repeating a genuine authority. And in fact, it is a great credit if one can do so honestly. Just like a bank teller is considered to be a trusted member of the company because of his honesty, because he does not interfere in any way, nor does a postman interfere in any way. Both of them are messengers of a sort. So similarly, we are also meant to be like the postman, like the bank teller. We're meant to deliver the message of the Bhagavatam unadulterated. Srila Prabhupada often said that if I have got any credit, it is only this, that I have not changed anything which I heard from my Guru Maharaj. I have simply delivered it without making any alteration. So we can understand that this is a success of a disciple, that he can represent purely and truly what he has heard from his spiritual master, what he has learned from his spiritual master, without feeling the need to speculate upon it or concoct. In that regard, we can say that the present-day parampara, which is going on amongst the intellectual animals of the universities, is a very different sort of parampara, because there, a professor takes great pride in giving birth to a student who can speculate. The more a student can speculate and manipulate philosophy, the more proud the professor becomes, saying, "See, this is my protege. Just see how nicely and originally he can concoct." So we don't do that. Our preference for a disciple is for the disciple who can repeat with faith and devotion, both in words and actions, what he has learned from the parampara system of the acharyas. So, Therefore, Srila Prabhupada was never intimidated in the face of any kind of apparent contradictory information coming from such seemingly bona fide authorities like the scientists. The other day, someone asked me a question in public. Do you believe? It was in the El Reno Federal Penitentiary. I went to visit them for their annual Easter Sunday sermon. It was on Saturday. So one of the prisoners who reads our books very faithfully said, "Do you hold to what your spiritual master says, that the moon is further away from the earth than the sun?" So I said, "Yes, I hold to whatever Srila Prabhupada says, and Prabhupada holds to whatever the Vedas say. And you will see one day that the scientists will be revealed for exactly what they are, a bunch of cheating speculators. We may not be able to demonstrate at this time, but gradually we shall demonstrate the truthfulness of the Bhagavatam's message. It is simply a question of our determination to stick to the teachings without fear. So, let us see what is written in this verse today. First of all, it is mentioned that the cities will be dominated by thieves. And as Srila Charidev points out, Central Park is a very unsafe place. We have experience in our own movement of one of our devotees, Nanda Kishore, who got practically sledgehammered over the head right in broad daylight. And I have got also experience when I was a young child that I was playing with my friends, and these hoodlums jumped out from the bushes and captured one of the children and raped her and held us at knife point. And it was right in broad daylight in Central Park. So such things are going on all over the world. Crime and what to do, Prabhupada says. Crime and what to do. Repeating the Time Magazine article or Newsweek article that came out, we know what to do and we know why there is crime. But the persons who are unqualified, who control the government, have no understanding whatsoever. Why people become thieves, for example. How can they not become thieves in a civilization which is simply encouraging sense gratification, where everyone's senses are so much agitated that a person feels that unless I can constantly gratify my senses, unless I have the means by which my senses can be constantly satiated with one type of object after another, I will be suffering, I will be miserable. And therefore they have thieves. Because even a wealthy man becomes a thief in this age. Even businessmen are practically plundering the consumers with unjust pricing and so many other products which are not even properly made. For example, automobiles. Is it not a type of cheating and thievery that they make automobiles purposely to break down so that you'll have to buy another automobile? You'll have to go and get spare parts. Knowingly, they can make automobiles that can last 100 years, practically. They can make automobiles that will give you 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 miles in a gallon. But they won't do that. Because they're all collectively engaged in the business of thievery. And in fact, the Kali Yuga is based on that. Interpersonal dealings are based on cheating. So, within our organization of ISKCON, we have to provide an alternative. There cannot be this business of thievery. There has to be honesty. Honesty and hard work. These are two qualities which we must find in persons who want to join us. When we admit someone to live within our centers, you have to note these two points. Is someone honest and is he willing to work hard? If he's neither, then don't let him stay in the center. thieves can't be tolerated. And there has to be this honesty on our parts. And everybody, therefore, has to get sufficient. All of his needs have to be met sufficiently. Our movement is meant for providing everyone with the basic necessities of life so that they will not feel unnecessarily harassed to have to steal from another person. The Vedas will be contaminated by speculative interpretations of atheists. Not only, as Srila Charidev points out, are the professors in the universities commenting in an atheistic manner, but so are so many so-called sadhus and sannyasis in India. They touch the Vedas just like the serpent touches milk, because the Vedas are compared to be like life-giving milk. And these impersonalists who interpret the Vedas are just like poisonous serpents. As soon as the Vedic mantras come out of their mouth, it is like milk which has been touched by the lips of a serpent. It produces poisonous effect. Anyone who hears the Vedic teachings from an impersonalist will lose his enthusiasm, his faith for serving Krishna. Therefore, we can only hear the Vedic literature spoken by bona fide speakers. A bona fide speaker is a speaker who has surrendered himself unto the disciplic succession and accepts the personal form of Krishna or Vishnu or Lord Ramachandra or one of the bona fide incarnations of the Supreme Lord. Neither demigod worshippers nor covered atheists in the form of impersonalists are qualified to be heard from. And we have to be very strict about this. As soon as someone is detected to be an impersonalist, you cannot allow yourself to hear their speculations. It is offensive. They misconstrue the teaching so terribly. Just like we were seeing in India with Prabhupada, how there was one edition of the Gita in which it described Krishna as the dark unknown within. The dark unknown within. And this four-volume edition of the Gita was very popular in India. And the translator and commentator was very popular, and today is a very popular speaker. And yet he's so ignorant of the science of God that instead of understanding that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, the Lord of Vrindavan, he's saying Krishna means the dark unknown within. And Prabhupada often quotes another Gita in which it mentions that where it says surrender unto Krishna, the commentator actually says what this means is not actually to Krishna, but to the unborn within, right? The unborn within, something of this type. So that they'll actually contradict directly. They're bold and brash in their behavior that right in the face of the translation, they'll contradict the very statement that actually this is not what it means. Or where Krishna says, do like this, they'll say, actually, that is not possible in this age. You should not do like this. So our business is to preach very strongly the clear teachings of the Bhagavatam, the Gita. Srila Prabhupada dedicated the Bhagavad Gita to Baladev Vidyabhushan, who wrote his Govinda Bhashya commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. So anyone who studies this commentary written by Srila Baladev Vidyabhushan will see how all of the arguments which this great personality has presented have been caught up so nicely by Prabhupada in using in his Gita commentary. It's not that our direction, our path, which has been chalked up by Prabhupada, is something which he has come up with on his own. This is exactly in keeping with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and all of his great followers. Our understanding of Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Who is Krishna? Who is the soul? What is the relationship between the soul and Krishna? How is the material creation coming about? What is the understanding of the different incarnations? How do they all derive their origin from Krishna? There's nothing speculative here, nothing original. The originality is only that it is presented in our own language. That is as far as originality should go. Prabhupada said that you can take the liberty to explain these teachings in your own words, in such a way that the public will understand, whatever that may happen to be. Just like someone like Adidev is doing it through art, someone else may be doing it through music, someone else may be doing it directly in terms of repeating the words through preaching activities. Someone else may be doing it in the form of cooking, just like in Hong Kong we cook Chinese style. That is explaining the philosophy in your own words. So it has to be done like that. The message of Krishna to develop within the public the feeling of wanting to devote themselves to Krishna, that we have to see. If that comes through, then it is successful preaching. And it will only come through if the essence is not in any way interfered with. The essence must be kept intact. We cannot change that. Only the form or structure may be slightly adjusted to the time, the place, and circumstance. That is the originality of a preacher, and that will determine a preacher's success. The successful preacher is he who can understand exactly how to preach in a particular situation, but without in any way compromising the philosophy. As soon as the philosophy is compromised, the potency becomes lost. So, factually we see that in India, our movement has already come out ahead. That there are so many big swamis and yogis and sannyasis who are preaching Vedanta, and none of them have the prominence of our movement. Similarly, already it is an established fact amongst many professors in the United States that the Hare Krishna movement is a bona fide Vedic tradition. And you will see that gradually, as our publications increase, as the translation of various Vedic literatures and commentaries are published more and more, our movement will be accepted as legitimate understanding of the Vedas, and not these impersonal interpretations which are currently in vogue. People have to understand this. Whenever I'm asked in public, well, what is the difference between your religion and the present-day religions, like Christianity? I say, in essence, there is no difference. The only difference is that we practice what we preach. Otherwise, there's no difference. Basically, it's the same tradition, that there is one supreme God, and that everybody has to be devoted to Him. And we call Him by Krishna, because in Sanskrit, He's known as Krishna. Political leaders will virtually consume the citizens. Certainly consuming in so many ways, through taxation, for example. In India, until recently, taxation of income was up to 97% of a man's income could be taxed. 97%. Therefore, the black market dealings were so active. Everybody could understand the only way I'm going to make any money is by making it unofficially. Because otherwise I'll starve. 97% of your money. What encouragement is there to a man to work hard if he knows that 97% of his income will be taken by the government? Now they've come down with the new prime minister to 50%. But even 50% is very excessive. Because where is the return on that 50%? Most of it is spent on useless things like family planning to encourage people to get abortions or use contraceptives. On national defense, to arm the world so that we can all destroy each other. In other words, people work and they see their money completely abused like this by rascal leaders. The qualification of a leader is that he knows how to become God conscious, and he knows how to give protection and facility to others to become God conscious. That is real leadership. We have to educate the public until eventually they kick out such rascal leaders as we presently have. Our business is not to kick them out. Our business is to inform and educate the public so that one day the public will demand their resignation. Not just that they catch one Nixon and put in another cheating Nixon. Everybody's very proud that, you see, here's the democratic process. We could expose that this man was cheating. But do you think that the others are not cheating? Only they did not get caught. Nixon's only crime is that he got caught. Because otherwise, what he does, everyone does. Everything is done in the same way. So our leadership and our movement has to be different. In every respect, we have to show the real positive alternative. Our leaders must be very, very perfect in their behavior, in what they speak, in what they do, both publicly and privately. This is very, very essential. Otherwise, there'll be a loss of faith. It's very, very important that we should teach by example. It's not enough simply that we can know the philosophy, but we have to exemplify the teachings. And ultimately, the highest teaching is to develop love for Krishna. There will be no more convincing point than when our devotees have developed real love for Krishna. That will actually impress the hearts of the public more than any other factor. Because when one has genuine love for Krishna, all good qualities are seen within that person. So, most importantly, we have to give proper attention to this fact also, that I have to root out any impurities that are within me by very sincerely following the process of Krishna consciousness. You should understand that you will not be able to fulfill the instructions which you receive from your spiritual master unless you're making an effort to progress in spiritual life. A devotee should be prepared to do anything and everything to make advancement spiritually. He should not be attached to any situation or any service. He should only be attached to one thing. How may I advance my spiritual life? So the spiritual master, these senior Vaishnavas are experienced devotees who can help you to understand how to disentangle yourself gradually from the modes of material nature. Because this is our problem, that we have attraction to the modes of material nature. Goodness, passion, and ignorance in their many varieties. They attract us in the form of so many different sense objects. And the attraction is there within our consciousness. It's intermingled. Our consciousness is mingled now with the mode of goodness, with the mode of passion, within the mode of ignorance. And you have to make your consciousness so purified that it only mixes in with Krishna, not with anything else, that it penetrates through whatever mode may be before you, and it only takes its shelter within Krishna. Just like when we go into so many circumstances, we have to be able to see through each situation, through each meeting, through each factor that happens to come before us, Krishna. If you can't find out Krishna in all circumstances, it means you're still attached and affected by the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. A pure transcendentalist is never undone by any situation. He can never be fooled. Can never be fooled in any way, lured. Just like Haridas Thakur, he sees a prostitute, he sees Krishna. He sees, oh, here is a devotee of Krishna. Here is a soul that will be devoted to Krishna. He never thinks, here is a prostitute. Here is the mode of passion presenting itself before me. Let me take advantage. Because the mode of passion doesn't exist within him. Therefore, there's no relationship in that way. Rather, because he's in the pure mode of pure goodness, he sees the person as spirit soul. So if we purify our consciousness so that we're only affected and influenced by the mode of goodness, pure goodness, sudasattvic, pure goodness, then under all circumstances we will find out the essential spiritual truth of the situation and not be undone in any way. We have to set such goals. You see, here's a good principle of management, goal setting, isn't it? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, here's my goal, that when the high court magistrate is wearing tilak, then justice will be had. Just like we were walking with a number of points, just like they asked me, what is your goal on the television? I was saying in the car. And I told them, my goal is when the people of Texas say that we're proud of our Krishnas, we got the best Krishnas in all of America, our Texas Krishnas are the best. And I was walking down the street the other day and there was a bank. You know, there's a bank that's just been put up on the Gurley Street. So I was saying to one devotee that my goal is in 5 years that the bank will advertise that our address is, we are just one block from the Hare Krishna Center. Yeah. So, and actually then after making such a goal, then you have to make the, you have to chalk out what are the different methods to come to achieve that goal. This is how you do management. First of all, you set your priorities, your goals, and then you set up what are the ways in which to achieve that, and then you follow that plan. That's called a master plan. You follow it very, very carefully and properly. And then it's very easy to make progress. It's not some mystical way how management is done. How do you think all of these big companies in the world are successful? They don't just do it by chanting mantras. Our success is based, our purity is based on chanting our mantra, but there has to be solid planning behind it also. In anything you do, whether it's cooking a offering for the deity to get it done on time, whether it's setting up a festival on the street, you see, you have to do it in such a way which will bring you to the goal that you're trying to achieve. It's very nice and easy and pleasing to the mind for those who like to be clear-headed. If you are a dull-headed, confused type and you prefer that type of mentality, then carry on. But if we want to have some clarity in our brain so that we can proceed and become very victorious and conquer in all directions, which is actually what Prabhupada and the previous acharyas are expecting of us, then we have to make first-class plans. And that can include even, ultimately it must include that the leaders of the world are devotees. It must be like that. Otherwise there's no hope that such a statement of the, you know, Bhagavatam will be reversed. Prabhupada said that our movement, Jai, here's Guru Prasad Maharaj, give him a cushion. Tall Texan. He's a real Texan. Hare Krishna. Prabhupada said that our movement should go down in history for having saved the world. Now that is quite a statement, isn't it? He Prabhupada said, here's your goal. You make the goal that the Hare Krishna movement will be recorded in the annals of history for having saved the earth. Now that is the goal. Now make sub-goals. How to achieve that. And then make the points, how to come to that point. That is planning. The founder gives the... This is the order coming down, parampara order. Save the world. Nothing less. Save the world from the pitfalls of Kali Yuga. So-called priests and intellectuals will be devotees of their bellies and genitals. We have seen that. The so-called priests all over the world. So many places. In India, I recall how at one of the temples, one of the original Goswami temples, we were dealing with them, and we wanted to increase the Seva Puja, the worship in the temple. We were prepared. Prabhupada offered them regular monthly stipend of money and to spend on the deity. But because they could not get any of the money personally, they refused. They refused. And we have seen many examples of how the priestly class has become simply concerned like this. It is a very shameless thing. One of the archbishops in France that Prabhupada spoke to, within a matter of weeks of Prabhupada speaking to him, he was found dead in the bed of a prostitute. So these things are going on. In all the different denominations of the world, it is going on. In Fiji, I always include in each of my lectures the description of how the pujaris often stumble around. One time, they drink the night before. They drink rock all night, and then they come in one. The first time I saw it, I thought there was something wrong with his leg. Then they told me that he was out all night, drinking grog while reading Ramayana. They have actually included that as part of the Ramayana reading in Fiji, that you break up the meeting by drinking grog, and then you go on reading.
Just like we have seen in churches also, they're doing so many things. Bingo, you know, regularly gambling. To increase the church treasury, gamble. I see. So, what has happened all over the world in this age? The priests and intellectuals are simply controlled by bellies and genitals. Now, we must not be guilty like that. Because in this day and age, there is not much respect for a religious person anymore. People tend to disrespect someone. They see us and they say, well, why don't you get a job and do something honest? This was considered to be the most noble calling in the world. In former times, if someone's son or daughter wanted to go into the priesthood, this was considered the most noble and honorable thing. If you had a son who became a priest, such an honorable thing. In India, it was always considered a great honor. Now you're told that, you know, why don't you do something honest, get a job instead of this? Because the leaders have become so bad. These spiritual leaders, these spiritual priestly class, have become so dishonest and degenerate in their behavior that no one respects them anymore. And it's just a known fact. Now, we have to show an example. We have to remain pure, not controlled by our bellies and genitals. That means you have to eat just enough. I was making this point, I think, yesterday in the class in Dallas, that everyone must know what is their proper weight and stick on that weight. Don't become too thick and don't become too thin. Just stick exactly on your weight in a regular way. Eat the same amount every day. Same time. Become very regular. The Bhagavad Gita says don't eat too much, don't eat too little. Don't be controlled by your bellies. And don't be controlled by the genitals. If one is too much agitated by the feeling for sex life, then they should get married. But within marriage also, they have to be very strict and proper in their conduct. Otherwise, husband and wife in spiritual life will disrespect each other if there is illicit sex within marriage. If the husband and wife strictly observe the principle of no illicit sex, they will always have an attraction, affection, and respect for each other. So even marriage is not a license for any kind of illicit sex. And ultimately, these two points and all matters of discipline require a taste for Krishna consciousness. You can only give up things which are unwanted. You can only learn to control your senses, your emotion, and your mind when they are concentrated on the positive fact of Krishna in all the different sensual ways. Seeing the deity, hearing the holy name, hearing the message of the Bhagavatam, meditating on the message of the Bhagavatam, association with the devotees, eating Krishna prasadam, these are the ways to actually purify our conscience in such a way that our consciousness becomes freed from the tendency for being controlled by the belly, the genitals, anger, etc. Vacha vegam, manasya krodha vegam, jiva vegam, urdhva pashta vegam, etan vegam, yova sahita dira, sarvam, what is that? Sarvam apimam pitivim sashishya. That then one becomes qualified to deliver hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. When one becomes in control of these different vegams, these pushings of the belly, and the genitals, and the mind, and the words, and anger. One has to learn to control all of these. Then one becomes qualified to deliver Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness cannot be delivered if one is not in control of his senses and mind. So you have to take the help of guru and sadhu and shastra. Genuinely take their help. Don't be too proud to take the help that one needs and chalk out a progressive path. Spiritual life should not be like this. It shouldn't go up and down. It should go progressively upwards. Even if it goes slowly, that's okay. It doesn't matter. But one has to find out the right situation according to our occupational activity and according to ashram, which will make it possible for us to go progressively forward. Never mind how slowly. It's better to go slowly forward than to go shooting up like a rocket and, you know, coming down, running out of fuel. And then, because when you try to launch it again, it's very hard. very hard to keep going through the atmosphere and coming back again. And the initial difficulty in space flight, isn't it, is to get through the gravitational pull. Once you're over that, you can go on and on. So the initial difficulties we face, if we can persevere and get through those initial difficulties, then gradually our path is clear. But if we get through them and then come crashing down again, then again you have to go through it. Very difficult. So try not to do that. Try to take the advice and guidance of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra and make a progressive march back to Godhead. So I think we'll stop here and ask if there are any questions. Yes?
Sri Gurudev, how can one understand that the scientists are trying to cheat? We can understand that the senses are imperfect, but they sincerely try to attain knowledge with their method of knowledge of experimentation.
Well, there was a newspaper article given to me yesterday. Here's Sunanda Prabhu. Come in, come in. Nice to see you in this atmosphere of Houston. I think you should stay here sometimes. It's like an effulgent personality. Here's Rasatala Prabhu. Soon there will be a reunion. Prana will come and it will be a big reunion. A battle of the bands. Must be something very special coming here with this Westheimer Festival. Why the people should get so much mercy like this. So many famous Sankirtan leaders, chanting leaders are here. Something special, isn't it? Gunagrahi Maharaj, Jayantakrit, all big kirtan leaders. Is that a big festival? Well, we'll see. If it happens, then we'll know it's special. But something must be special. These people must have done something to deserve this. Or else it's causeless mercy also. The Vaishnavas. Huh? Yeah, then that's the qualification. The seeds are planted. Now we have to water like crazy. It's also causeless mercy that the devotees are so eager to give Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy that they're just streaming here from all the directions. It's actually a special event. You can feel that so many persons come like this. So your question is about the scientists. Yes, the crazy scientists. Yesterday I saw an article, and now they have a new addition to the cosmic soup theory. It's called the mud theory. They say that life originated out of clay theory, not the mud, clay theory. That the clay, I have to admit it, they showed six frames and I stopped at the second frame, you know, when it started to describe how life can originate from clay. And if you tell me that they're using their intelligence and say things like that, they are. Their intelligence is misdirected. Krishna says that he's sitting sarvasya chaham ridishani vishto matish mitirganam apavanam cha. That he's sitting in the heart of all living entities and from him comes remembrance, intelligence, and forgetfulness. So their intelligence is being blocked. They're so atheistic and demonic that it's all being misdirected to the point where it's foolishness. Some of their postulations are just utterly foolish. I find it very hard to agree with you that they're very, very intelligent. When I read something like that, that life comes from clay, I just find it very hard to. And it's so obvious, you know, where did the clay come from? Where did the soup come from? Where did the oxygen, I mean, they name all of these chemicals that were originally there, where did they come from? Everyone sees that by different types of biological processes, different organisms give off different types of gases. So it stands to reason that there must be some origin which has produced the gases that they say are primordial. There's no, you cannot find anything primordial. Every single thing you can find in this world you can trace to a source. So because they can't accept that the source of all of those things was God, they say that was primordial. But there's no experience they have. They can ease, they're intelligent. They can see that every single thing within their vision, you know, microscopic or telescopic vision, comes from something. Why, therefore, do they say when it comes to the gas that it's primordial? It has no origin. They're cheaters. They are cheaters. They're simply cheaters. They're not at all honest. Therefore, I stand by whatever Prabhupada said about the moon and the sun. I stand by it. I make, just as Prabhupada said, anyway, even they have gone. And so we may also say, anyway, maybe the positions may have switched or not switched. But when this Bhagavatam was stated, whatever it states is absolutely true. Simply, we have to understand it properly, that's all. And then it will be able to be explained. Yes. Like children.
Like children, yeah. Like children.
So that means that a child's...
demonstrates that part. If our intelligence is developed, the more we know our surface.
The more we know...
The more we know, we find our surface.
Our selves, yes.
Our surface. How do you do that?
What's the question?
Do you think, you know, those...
Yes. Yes, they will. They will destroy themselves by technology unless we help them to use the technology properly. Technology is not bad. It's how you use it that determines whether it is good or bad. Technology is not bad. You find this thing bad, this microphone? Without it, you could not hear now. So it's not bad. It's being used nicely now. But if you use this, you know, to broadcast a message of hate, hate, fight, kill, yeah, what benefit does it? And that's what they do. They broadcast messages which are obnoxious and harmful to people instead of messages which are full of wisdom. So technology in itself is not bad. It's a question of how it's used. So it's our business to interfere with their use of the technology. The devotee's business is to be persuasive in interfering with the misuse of technology and teaching its proper use. Therefore, distribute these books, because these books are directives to anyone who is intelligent how to use the material world in the service of God. Therefore, we're stressing so much to distribute more books and more books and more books. Because the more these literatures go out, the more the incorrect understanding of what matter is meant for will be changed. People will be turned around in their proper understanding that matter is not to be rejected, but it's to be engaged in the service of spirit. When you use matter in the service of spirit, the matter becomes spiritualized. That's our business. But you can only spiritualize everything. It's like a magic wand. A devotee has a magic wand. But he can only do that if within his heart there is no desire for sense enjoyment. When the heart is free from the desire for sense enjoyment, then you won't be diverted. You will not try to enjoy the matter. You will easily be empowered to go around and spiritualize everything in your touch. You cannot have within your heart the desire to lord it over and enjoy. That desire has to be taken out, cleansed out, and the way is by chanting Hare Krishna. If you chant Hare Krishna, then your heart becomes clean and free from this tendency to want to enjoy whatever that enjoyment may be. And then you can be used as an instrument in Krishna's hands. So chant more, engage in the process of Krishna consciousness. Then you'll see that change take place. Any other questions?
You mentioned, or maybe
the point that the only difference between our religion and the other religions is that they have an essence, but isn't the fact that we fall and they don't fall. So then the argument may come back that someone can also analyze the activities of our movement and find out that the devotees are struggling hard in order to follow, not always following them, having all kinds of problems, which Christians certainly have, and all the others certainly have. But if we look in the other religions, we see also that there is a core of practitioners who are very serious and who do not transgress their principles, and who preach and who practice what they teach, basically. So if we look at it in proportions, how can we say that we are practicing?
Okay. I would give that answer, but still I would, and then another point can be made. Accepting what you say, the next point is that what we are teaching is a different degree of the same teachings. In other words, Krishna consciousness offers, for example, I think that you would find that if devotees were to try to follow the disciplines of other religions, the chances of them being successful would be much, much higher than the practitioners of those religions. For example, let us say that there are 100 people to take a PhD course and only 25 people pass. But I think that all 100 people would have been able to pass the BA course. So I think it would be very easy for the devotees to be extremely first class in any other religious practice, because this is the most demanding. So although it may be true that there is failure within our movement and on the part of so many individuals, but we should also see what they're attempting for. They're attempting for the most high of all things, to develop pure and unalloyed love for the Lord, free of any kind of, I mean, it's such a pure degree of love that we're actually trying to achieve for. So that's another distinction. But I'm saying to you that if I address that point to the public, they won't understand that point. To make that distinction, then it appears that then you're saying that this is the only way. Or you're saying that this is better than everything else. So in terms of practically going out in the public and preaching, I think that it's better to stress this point, that we practice what we preach. Because at least by and large, we try to do that very sincerely. And what we're trying to practice is much more difficult than what they're trying to practice. If I begin to explain that point also, I do sometimes explain that. But if I start to go into how this is a PhD course, then you have to consider who your public is. If you're addressing large audiences on television, I think that more than anything, then you'll be looked upon as someone who's just saying that you're better than everybody else. But people can respect when you say that you practice what you preach. And by and large, we do. In other words, they do view us like that. The fact that we wear robes, the fact that we shave our heads, these things are actually significant in terms of their conception of us. So although you're right, it may be just an external conception. In other words, when they address those questions to me about what do you see in terms of your religion and others, where's the difference? Visibly, there's a difference in their minds that the Hare Krishnas dress differently, shave their heads, so many chant. So I use this, I sort of categorize these differences as saying that we practice what we preach. We believe strongly enough that we practice it. We don't just give lip service to it. And by and large, I think you would find that the degree to which we do practice is, in general, much higher a degree than is seen in the congregation and membership of other religions. They're very, very watered down. I mean, I was reading only yesterday, it was in the recent issue of Time magazine, I saw an article in which this evangelist woman from Los Angeles, who has a very, very big following both on television and personally in her preaching, she suddenly got up and she announced that now I'm retiring, I'm going to give up this, and I want to just be a normal, good person. And I'm retiring, and if I come back again, I will try to encourage people in just doing, you know, good self-help works. But I'm giving this up, and I just want to get to know myself better, and I don't want to do this anymore. I'm tired of doing this, she said. It's too much strain on me. Just gave it up like a job. Just so cheating. So, I mean, we have to understand what modern religion has come to. You may find one, you know, group or another, and there are some, like, you know, monks and things in the Catholic Church, perhaps somewhere. But basically, if you examine what is going under the name of religion today, it's such complete hypocrisy and cheating that we are much more practicing what we preach. Even a devotee, I mean, where do you find, in the priesthood, you go and I've lectured in places where they're training priests, and they outrightly say that they don't observe celibacy. They outrightly say we have to smoke, we watch television. I mean, these are priests in the Catholic Church. So you may find some few people or some very small groups spread out, but where do you find a major religion like ours is becoming? All that's going into all countries of the world and actually getting, you know, large numbers of people to discipline their lives to the degree that we discipline ourselves. I mean, to the degree is pretty astonishing. Where any kind of, you know, deviation from service or meditation on Krishna is considered to be maya, illusion. Who demands so much of themselves and their followers as this discipline demands? So I still hold to that point, that basically we practice what we preach. I therefore say that if devotees were intelligent, they would go to their authorities and reveal their minds properly and reveal their heart properly. And if the authorities are astute enough, if they're intelligent enough, they'll be able to understand and properly set the devotee on the right spiritual course instead of trying to become like a rocket and blast out into outer space and then, you know, run out of fuel and come crashing down. Devotees, I think you will see, and this will happen gradually, that the devotee leaders will become more and more qualified to give the proper engagement and advice to the followers. You know, because initially when our movement began, everybody was more or less joining together. So the leaders were as inexperienced as the followers. There was really not a clear distinction. But now we have some leaders who are devotees nearly 20 years. Naturally, their ability to guide and direct followers who are only 2, 3, 4, 5 years in the movement, or even older followers, becomes a little bit more enhanced. By just merely by the increase of their own Krishna consciousness, they're in a better position now to give helpful and proper advice. And I think that I'm hopeful that we will see more and more of a success rate. Not more and more failure, more success as our leaders become more qualified to give good advice. The biggest reason for fall down is because the devotee was not properly situated according to varna and ashram. They did not have either the right ashram advice or the right varna advice. If those two are given properly and the devotee is sincere, there's a much better chance of success. Right, and furthermore, as our Krishna consciousness movement expands, it will be easier to be a devotee. Because there will be a whole background of Vedic culture. Just like, for example, everyone likes to listen to music. Now, the fact is that we don't have much music to listen to, unless you want to keep listening to the same tapes. And I know for a fact that no one does that anymore. No one can just be satisfied listening to the same tapes. That's just the way it is. And anybody says, I am, there's hardly any like that. So there's a desire for a whole background of musical culture, for example. Or I hear of many devotees going to see movies. I have never gone to a movie, only one time in my whole spiritual life since initiation did I ever go to a movie, and that was to see Sampurna Ramayan. It was in Hindi, in India. But I know the reason why. I don't know why they allow themselves to do it, but I know the reason is that there's a natural propensity to want to see some cinematography display. But then we have to make Krishna movies. And ITV is starting to do that in different ways. Entertainment. There has to be drama. There has to be, you know, so many different things so that we don't feel that we have to go outside the world of Krishna consciousness to enjoy. Very few people can simply chant like Haridas Thakur day and night. That's not possible. So as our movement progresses in time, the whole culture of Krishna consciousness will be expansive enough that it will become easier. One will not have to go out into the material world to gratify one's senses. You have to place yourself in a situation which demands of you a great deal of service. Because if by nature, constitutionally, we're servants of God, then it stands to reason that if we're engaged consistently in service, that if the service is the proper service for us, we'll find a satisfaction in serving rather than lording. So one should allow oneself to be placed in a full position of service, constant service, so that there's no idle time for the devil to start working. Well, I'm trying to say that. I understand what you're saying, and I'm giving my recommendation is that if one is engaged in service, that is the counteractive for the propensity for enjoying spiritually. In other words, I'll give you an example. Just like in the past, there was a tendency on one of our big devotees' parts to enjoy the holy name. That's right. That sounds very innocent. But it didn't become innocent. In this person's mentality, he developed the mentality of a sahajiya, enjoying the holy name, enjoying Krishna. We're not supposed to enjoy Krishna. We're supposed to let Krishna enjoy us. So instead of trying to enjoy the holy name like that, how much nicer it is, for example, if someone goes out with a kirtan party or a bhajan group and serves the holy name. The holy name is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The holy name is Krishna himself. So if someone does service to Krishna by offering the holy name to so many other people, that's a way of serving the holy name. And I'm saying that through that service, that will become more satisfying than simply sitting on one's own and trying to enter into the ecstasy of enjoying the holy name. I'm trying to say that there should be a way to counteract the spiritual enjoying propensity is to place oneself in a serving mood. Service is the opposite of, you know, when we say, when you were mentioning enjoy, it means proprietor or lording over tendency. So the opposite of the lording over tendency is the serving mood. So if we can place ourselves in each context in a service mood of service spirit, that will counteract it. Yes.
For instance, I'm very attracted to preaching, and in my mind I say I like to go to preach because I like it. And I have a hard time to put myself in saying I like to go I want to go preaching to please Krishna.
Yes. So
I enjoy preaching, so I say, I enjoy it so much, so let me do it because I enjoy it. And it's hard to preach to please Krishna.
Yes, and I think that to some extent your preaching may be inhibited in its success because of that. In other words, there's a lot of, right now I've been enjoying writing. But for 2.5 months I have not written anything. Because out of duty, my godbrothers have come forward to me and they have said that we need you, Krishna needs you to serve in the following ways more than any other thing right now, even more than your writing or anything else. So I understand that I'm Krishna's servant. So whether I like to write and want to write now or not, I consider that what Krishna wants and needs from me is more important than what I would like to do for him. In other words, I'm acting out of duty. First and foremost, I'm acting out of duty. When I say I'm acting out of duty, I don't mean to say I feel it is spontaneously acting out of duty. In other words, I don't have to have my arm, you know, twisted around my back to act that way, I'm very happy. But my point is that I'm not allowing my personal preference. Preferably, Prabhupada wanted to write. I mean, I don't consider that I'm a great writer, and that's another reason why I don't mind doing the other things, which I might even be better at than writing. But Prabhupada was the greatest of writers, and he had the most important message, and no one could ever do what Prabhupada could do by writing. So if he had his way, which he repeatedly told us, please let me retire so I can write. But he, even though that was what he enjoyed and wanted to do most, he was putting that aside for what he felt was needed in terms of duty. To give association to his disciples, to answer letters, to manage, on and on and on, all the things he said he had to do. So I feel that, you know, our older devotees especially have to recognize that still they're duty-bound. Just like a man feels his duty to his wife and child, and he knows that even though I don't always like to do my duty, I'm duty-bound. So I feel that we are all duty-bound to this movement. We are duty-bound to this movement to do our duty. We all have responsibility. Too often I see that someone feels, that forgets or puts aside the duty that they have to this family of ISKCON. They think that I have to maintain my family. But is this not your family? That you have to maintain this family also. It's a greater family, but it's the family. And just to maintain your own family, thinking it's mentioned, and I'll show you, if I can find it, just an interesting point. Here it says that that in the Kali Yuga, it mentions that the only way... By the time of the age of Kali ending, family ties will extend no further than the immediate bonds of marriage. Don't interrupt, please. I'm in the middle of a lecture. It says in the Kali Yuga, family ties will extend no further than the immediate bonds of marriage. So, very often we see in our own movement that people are they have done this already. They consider their family to be only husband, wife, and immediate children. But I say that an original Vedic family, it included the father and all the brothers, wives of the brothers, and all their children and children's children, and they all lived in one home. And a man knew that he never thought, I have to maintain my wife and children. He thought, I have to help to maintain the whole family. So we're supposed to be established on that principle. This is a symptom of the Kali Yuga, that the brothers cannot live together. That they have to all live in their own home, and they only think, I have to maintain my wife and children. I don't think like that. I personally don't think that, and I never saw Prabhupada think like that. Not after he established ISKCON, he did not think like that. Now you may argue, but he did when he was a grihastha. But after establishing ISKCON, he tried to get everybody to understand the principle of serving the greater family. I cannot imagine a man in India, for example, seeing his father and mother starving and thinking it doesn't matter because I'm looking after my wife and children. Nobody would think like that, you see? So similarly, to see a temple, the temple means the family business, the family home. That must be flourishing. That's the most important duty of a son or a daughter. Then you also see how you're living. Not that you care for yourself. Then it becomes just like what it says here, a symptom of the Kali Yuga. So duty, one has to act out of duty. Even though the propensity, maybe I would prefer to do like this, I prefer to do like that, one should try to act on the point of duty. And not enjoy the situation. We should not, Prabhupada said to me, remember in the letter he wrote, do not try to dovetail sense gratification in the name of Krishna consciousness. Do not try to dovetail sense gratification in the name of Krishna consciousness. You have to search, each of you, in your own lives and see, am I doing that? And if you're sincere, you'll make a change. You will not go on dovetailing sense gratification in the name of Krishna consciousness. You will act out of duty. And when you do that, you get a satisfaction that's greater than if you try to dovetail that enjoying tendency. The highest, when you know your spiritual master is pleased, with you. Nothing is more satisfying. And you can know it. Our conscience tells us. Our conscience is telling us these things. You can tell when you have a feeling of guilt within your mind. That you know I'm not doing what would be the most pleasing. And when you do it, even though you had a different, then you meet it, even if it's not so successful, somehow you feel, I'm protected, I'm safe, this is good. So, I think that we have to stop here. It's getting late. Everybody probably has activities to do. Tomorrow I'll be giving class at what time?
Regular time.
Oh. Okay, so I think we'll end here. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga.